Today we're starting Ecclesiastes 11, and as I look at my Bible, the way mine is laid out, as I open to this, I see the rest of the book. What remains, it's really not that much. Chapter 11 is on the short side, and then we just have one more, and we will be done. So it won't be too many more weeks before we finish up the series that has been occupying us for, I think, about a year. And we are going to take a break for Passion Week and Resurrection Sunday, and there'll be some other special events early in the summer, but before too long we will be finishing this up, Lord willing. And today, as we come to chapter 11, we're continuing, in generally speaking, the same vein as we have been in chapter 10, with its focus on the wise use of our resources in life, responding to a lot of the challenging aspects of life that this book has laid out, and striving to make the best choices as possible, avoiding folly and pursuing wisdom. But it is taking us in a specific direction along those lines, and we'll read the passage here in a moment. Our text today is going to be verses 1 to 6. But let me begin by reading something else that Solomon wrote, and you can listen as I read what he has to say about a certain category of fool, the sluggard. And this is coming from Proverbs 23. The sluggard says, "There is a lion in the road. There is a lion in the streets." As a door turns on its hinges, so does a sluggard on his bed. The sluggard buries his hand in the dish. It wears him out to bring it back to his mouth. The sluggard is wiser in his own eyes than seven men who can answer sensibly. And the first of those verses, Proverbs 23:13, in that little statement, the sluggard says, there is a lion in the road, there is a lion in the streets. What you have is a picture of somebody who is using potential dangers, even ridiculous ones, as an excuse for delaying work and for remaining unengaged in the business of life. So with that excuse, he just turns over one more time and continues sleeping. Well, that picture of that sluggard using the excuse of potential dangers out there to keep him from getting engaged in life, that is the antithesis of the spirit that Solomon, now in our text, is encouraging, and what he is urging us with in this passage. And I'll go ahead and read now Ecclesiastes chapter 11, verses 1 to 6. Cast your bread upon the waters, for you will find it after many days. Give a portion to seven or even to eight, for you know not what disaster may happen on earth. If the clouds are full of rain, they empty themselves on the earth. And if a tree falls to the south or to the north, in the place where the tree falls, there it will lie. He who observes the wind will not sow, and he who regards the clouds will not reap. As you do not know the way the spirit comes to the bones in the womb of a woman with child, so you do not know the work of God who makes everything. In the morning, sow your seed, and at evening, withhold not your hand, for you do not know which will prosper, this or that, or whether both alike will be good. One of the ways I believe this passage hangs together as a unit is that it begins and it ends with commands. It is sandwiched by two commands on either side, two of them at the beginning, verses 1 and 2, and two of them at the end in verse 6. And they are related commands. They actually are saying much the same thing at the beginning and the end of the passage. They're using different images, different spheres of life, and I think that fact is indicative of the way that Solomon would have us to apply this. In other words, he is not wanting us to narrow the topic of discussion to any one area of life. He's actually pulling from different areas to make the point, and he's beginning and ending the passage along those lines. And really, all of these commands work together to get across one central idea. What are the commands? Look at the first one there in verse 1. It says, cast your bread upon the waters. There's an image for you. It's so much of a metaphor that we have trouble figuring out what it is that Solomon is getting at. And there are different approaches to it. But in my mind, the most likely point of this, as far as the image is concerned, what he has in mind, is referring to maritime commerce. In other words, going to other places on ships in order to do business. And the bread there is talking about the grain, which was used to make bread, that could be taken to some other place where maybe they didn't have so much of it, and that you could use it to trade with, to do business with, and come back home with some other asset that maybe you might not have enjoyed in your place as much. The sending of grain and other agricultural products on ships to faraway countries with the expectation of those ships coming back with good things for you to enjoy. Kind of like the wife in Proverbs 31:14, where it says, she is like the ships of the merchant. She brings her food from afar. Similar image there. So he is referring there probably to this business being conducted over sea. Cast your bread upon the waters. What about verse 2? Give a portion to 7 or to 8. Again, there are different ways to understand that. And there are some who take it as a lesson in giving, as in the benevolence offering that we're going to collect as the service closes today. That sort of thing, distributing your alms generously and giving widely and really looking for whatever way you can to be a help and a blessing to those in need. I think that would be a wonderful application, and that would be a great thing to do generally with or without this passage. But as I look at the context, it doesn't strike me that this is a passage that is highlighting the idea of giving to the poor. In fact, I believe that we want to take that second verse in connection with the first one. This is how it is often understood by commentators, that the idea of this commerce on ships is still in view, and the 7 or the 8 refers actually to ships. Think about it in that regard, that this has to do with sending out these products and distributing your efforts to engage in business in a wide array of vessels. Why? Because if you sent out only one and something happens, then there goes your entire load. And so the idea is split it up among several vessels. In fact, be as diverse as you possibly can. In the Old Testament, often the number 7 suggests that which is complete, sort of the full number. And here he is upping that by one. In other words, do just as much as you can to kind of split things up, distribute it, if possible, among 8 vessels as you are carrying out these efforts. Today, we would call that diversifying your assets. As you're out there making an investment, as you're out there trying to engage in business, we would also say don't put all of your eggs in one basket, because something could go wrong and you would lose all of your assets at once in one venture. Kind of split it up. Do various kinds of activities. That's the thrust of this. And what about the commandments that close up the passage in verse 6? Now he switches to a different area of life, not commerce, not going out on a ship to make some business, but now it's an agricultural image. As he says in verse 6, in the morning sow your seed, and at evening withhold not your hand. He's talking about farmers. He's talking about planting seed. And the idea that these men should get out of bed early, that they should get out there to the fields, that they should get busy about the work of planting, and that they should stay at it The second line says, and at evening, withhold not your hand. The little preposition at could be better translated until. So, in other words, do it early in the morning until the sun goes down. In other words, be diligent all day long about it. It is suggesting a real energy and a follow through where these farmers are out in the field putting out a full day of labor, not checking out, not clocking out halfway through, not putting in a half day of sort of dipping in a little bit and kind of experimenting to see if they like it or see if it happens, something happens right away, but to stick with it all day long, a whole day of labor, making an earnest effort with this opportunity. Now think back on those commands. Cast your bread upon the waters. Give a portion to seven or even to eight. In the morning sow your seed, and at evening withhold not your hand. What do those four commands, what do they have in common? And how do they work together to get across one central idea that unifies this passage? They basically are telling you to get out there in life and do something. Get out there in life and be productive. Don't be like the sluggard who's worried about what could happen that could mess up his efforts. Get out there and be busy. This is what the wise man does. He does something. He is active. He takes advantage of whatever opportunity that he has. And that spirit, that attitude, is in response to what has gone before all throughout in Ecclesiastes. You know, throughout this book, there have been so many passages that have made us painfully aware of the problems and the frustrations and the injustices of life. And we could respond to that by getting very protective about our lives, by retreating from engagement with this fallen world because so many things could go wrong that would hurt us, that would cause us to suffer. And there would be all kinds of measures we could take to try to isolate and to insulate our lives in order to avoid failure, in order to avoid pain. That would be an overreaction to what Ecclesiastes has had to say. On the other hand, there has been, especially in chapter 10, this growing emphasis on wisdom, on making skillful choices. And part of that is to help you minimize, to whatever degree possible, the suffering that is out there, to try to be as successful as possible. And you remember the image of sharpening the axe. We talked about that as one of the ways that he communicates that idea of being as smart as you can about using your abilities and your opportunities. But, you know, even that wisdom idea could become an excuse. Once again, it could be another way that we respond extremely to the potential problems in life. And I mean that you can become so cautious and be so, quote unquote, wise, or we might say today, so conservative and so careful that you don't do much of anything because you're looking for protection. Or it takes you forever to make any decisions and get anything done because you're being so careful about it. Okay? That would be to overdo it. That would be to be wiser than even the Lord is telling you to be here. There really is a balance here. And it's not always easy to keep these things going in our lives at the same time. And that, I believe, is what this passage is going to help us with. You know, depending on your personality type, you could fall into one of those categories very easily. If you are kind of a fearful person, you retreat just because you're concerned that something bad might happen. Or if you're kind of on the carefulness, positive wisdom end of things, you could be so cautious that you don't get a whole lot done in life. And yet for everyone, no matter what your circumstances are, no matter what your personality type might be, no matter what your past experience might be, The message of this passage is the same. The exhortation is the same. And this portion of God's word is telling you, it's telling me to venture out. To venture out. That is the title of the message this morning. Venture out. And this is one of several responses to the problems of life that we face under the sun. One of several responses, not extreme, not imbalanced, but the right sort of responses that Ecclesiastes is urging us toward. It's not the only response, and I do want to keep this in context with everything else that is still to come. Really, as you consider the brokenness of this world, the frustrations that we're all likely to face, the failures that we might encounter, what ultimately this book is working to do is to encourage us, to urge us not to idolize life on earth. And there have been many frustrations we have covered that have basically left us saying, this world does not cut it. I cannot rely on it for ultimate satisfaction. It is going to let me down in all kinds of ways. I'm going to be frustrated, even when I'm doing the quote unquote right thing. And all of that, the Lord is urging us to think about in light of eternity and to move us toward Him, not to idolize earthly life, but to respond by nurturing something that lasts, and that would be our relationship with Him. And that response is actually how the book is going to end. That's going to be the focus at the end of chapter 12. So we're getting there. Another response that we have seen is that even while the book is very realistic about how these things don't ultimately satisfy you, there is still a right temporal enjoyment that God wants you to experience when you realize, look, this stuff isn't my God, but this stuff, this is a gift from God. And He wants me to take it for what it is, not to make it my God, but to enjoy the pleasure it does provide and to use that as a way of turning around and worshiping Him for His goodness. So we have talked about the theme of enjoying the temporal blessings of life. We've encountered that many times before. And actually, that's what the close of chapter 11 and the beginning of chapter 12 are going to come back to. That's going to surface again. So we have those two responses. As you face the troubles of life, may it urge you to move, to focus on your walk with the Lord. May it also, in a secondary application, may it move you to enjoy what He has provided as a matter of His goodness, so long as you don't idolize it. Those are the two themes that we have just come back to again and again and that are going to get reiterated as the book closes. But neither of those responses is quite the theme of this paragraph. I think this paragraph stands out as kind of unique in this book because it's actually giving us yet another way to respond. Here Solomon is continuing to describe wisdom, but he tells us, okay, here is what wisdom urges you to do. Here is what a wise life actually looks like. It is a life that engages fully in the activities that are before us. It is a life that works diligently. It is a life that even develops a kind of adventuresome spirit about it. It tries new endeavors. It takes risks if need be. It seizes the variety of opportunities that it finds for advancement and productivity. And it steps out in faith and it does something in life. It is not content to just sit around and be safe all the time. It gets out there and steps out in faith to accomplish worthy purposes. It ventures out. And although Solomon is talking specifically here about commerce and agriculture, they really are just illustrations of the kind of active, aggressive attitude that a wise person pursues throughout life and in whatever area of life. So, venture out. That, in short, is what I want to say this morning, and it's what's being said here in this passage. Now, you may still be a little skeptical. about that emphasis. And so we're going to look more closely at this passage, and we're going to see three arguments for this kind of aggressive, adventuresome activity. When we come to verses 1 and 2, what we find is this argument: venture out because of the consequences. Venture out because of the consequences. And there are good consequences that naturally are being put out there for you as that which is available if you venture out. Look at verse 1. This is where we have this image of commerce. Cast your bread upon the waters. Why? For you will find it after many days. You see there the encouragement. You're going to get something out of this. There will be worthy rewards. And we're not necessarily talking here about only spiritual or eternal rewards. He's talking about earthly life. That's really the general topic of discussion in this book. The expectation for these merchants is that at some point the ships are going to come back and they're going to return with good things. They're going to make some kind of profit. Now, there is a little caveat here that will be very important to keep in mind. It says, cast your bread upon the waters, for you will find it when? After many days. In other words, the results may not be overnight. And there may be all kinds of other experiences you have along the way while you wait. You're going to find it after many days. Sometimes it takes a lot of waiting and a lot of time before we see the good consequences of these kinds of faith-filled, risky choices. Solomon knew this from experience. As you read the stories of his reign in 1 Kings 10:22, you find this little statement. For the king had a fleet of ships of Tarshish at sea with the fleet of Hiram. Once every 3 years, the fleet of ships of Tarshish used to come bringing silver, ivory, apes, and peacocks. And all of these fascinating animals and all of this wealth, these precious stones that kept adding and adding to the glory of the kingdom of Solomon. A lot of it was brought from other countries and it was brought through ships. And who knows, maybe he was taking himself grain over to those lands to do business with these people. But my point is that they came back every 3 years. It took some time. There was a lot of waiting and there was a lot of patience that had to be exercised there. And you know, I find that this principle is very relevant for us because sometimes you and I hesitate to pursue some activity because we have tried before to do things and we have stepped out before in faith and nothing came from it. It fell to the ground. We really didn't see any profit. We wondered whether we had wasted our time. Maybe the reason was, not the only possible reason, but in light of this verse, maybe the reason was that we did not persevere with it over a long enough time. Maybe we gave up too easily. And that is such a problem in our age where we're used to instant everything. And we are so accustomed to immediate communication and getting feedback and response right away. Really, the best things in life don't come overnight. Whether you and I are talking about relationships, whether we're talking about something that we're striving to do in the workplace, whether it is some ministry that we want to have in somebody else's life, the reality is it can take a long, long time for your efforts to become productive. And there are a lot of other situations, events, frustrations that happen during that waiting period. Now, I think I could defend even another point from this text, because you would look at it and say, well, at least it's saying that if I wait long enough, I will find it. There will be some kind of consequence. Well, you want to remember that this is proverbial material. that this is a proverb. That is the kind of literature that we're considering. These things ought not to be taken as ironclad promises, certainly not, that in our efforts in life, ultimately, we're going to get all the results that we could possibly want. In fact, like another verse I pointed out earlier, it is possible that the way this ought to be translated is as a modal. For you will find it after many days, is what our version says. But, for example, the NIV says, after many days, you may receive a return. In other words, it's not suggesting that this is definitely going to happen, but that this is a great likelihood. And this is a positive attitude to have about it, to be expectant. Now, somebody could listen to that after many days, you may receive a return, and come back and say, well, if it's only a possibility, and if there are no guarantees, then actually this doesn't strike me as an argument for striking out in faith and venturing out. This actually hits me as an argument not to venture out because there are no guarantees. Well, the next verse actually argues with you in the opposite direction. And it speaks about the bad consequences of what would happen and what does happen so often when we aren't venturing out, and particularly when we're not doing a variety of things in life, pursuing good purposes in various realms. That's verse 2. Give a portion to 7 or even to 8, for you know not what disaster may happen on earth. That's the point about diversifying assets. Even while taking great risks, wisdom still exercises a measure of caution. The verse suggests actually the strong likelihood that some of your efforts are not going to pan out, that some of them are going to be unprofitable, and you just don't know which ones they are, right? You know not what disaster may happen on earth. And if you send out those 8 ships or whatever, that's a helpful thing to do, and it provides a good measure of security, but you really don't know which one of those ships is going to be lost. There is always a measure of uncertainty in life and our efforts in life. This has been one of Solomon's big points about it. But he's saying that doesn't mean you shouldn't do anything. It just means you should go out and do a lot of things, because probably some of them are going to fail. And if you don't do anything, you're not going to accomplish anything profitable in life. He's being very practical about this. In a fallen world, we actually expect a certain amount of wasted effort, a certain amount of failure. I think to speak to the young people, you ought to go into life expecting that some of the things you're striving to do are just not going to work out for all kinds of reasons, but you need to expect a measure of failure. And even with the analogy of these ships, in a fallen world, you expect a measure of catastrophe, things going seriously wrong, and the possibility that any of us could face an enormous amount of grief and sadness. If there is anything you expect in life, it is unexpected trouble. If there's anything you expect in life in a fallen world, it is unexpected trouble. But again, Solomon says the response to that isn't to stay in bed and do nothing. It actually is the opposite. It means you work even harder by the grace of God, and you get involved in a variety of efforts. You definitely won't get anything at all if you don't try anything. Here's an illustration. Quote, In Babe Ruth's era, the average player struck out only 8.1% of the time. By contrast, Ruth struck out nearly twice as often as his peers, or 15.8% of the time. That is 1,330 times over 8,330 399 official at-bats. So almost 16% of the times Babe Ruth struck out, and that was twice as much as the average player. In fact, he led the league in strikeouts five times in his career. Can you imagine that would be the thing you're known for that year? Averaging 61 strikeouts per season over his 22-year career. On the other hand, Babe is still ranked third in the all-time list of home run hitters. In other words, stepping up to the plate and swinging repeatedly involves both risk and opportunity. If your goal is to seem perfect by avoiding risk, let me say that again. If your goal is to seem perfect by avoiding risk, you may look good on paper, but you will never make a mark on history either. And not that our goal is to make a mark on history in the sense that everybody's going to remember us, but just in talking about making any contribution at all to any purpose, to anybody's life, is going to involve some measure of failure along the way. Our efforts are going to involve a mix of success and failure, and the successes, possible successes, and the reality of the failures, both of those, according to this passage, are actually arguments for us to venture out. And so that's the first argument. Venture out because of the consequences. Number two, verses 3 and 4, venture out because of your limitations. And there's a very interesting and probing statement in verse 3, teaching us that one of our limitations is that we do not control the circumstances of our lives. He says in verse 3, if the clouds are full of rain, they empty themselves on the earth. And if a tree falls to the south or to the north, in the place where the tree falls, there it will lie. Maybe you've always wondered, what in the world is he talking about? What's the point? This doesn't seem very profound. If the clouds are full of rain, they empty themselves on the earth. Duh. If a tree falls to the south or to the north, wherever it falls, there it lies. Okay, wonderful. Really learned something. What is the point? Keep this all connected in context. Those are two illustrations of events that happen in quote-unquote nature. Those are events that happen and that are going to happen all the time, over and over, that you and I cannot predict when exactly or how exactly, and that you and I have no control over. That's the point. If it's going to rain, it's going to rain. If it's not going to rain, it's not going to rain. If the tree falls this way, there it's going to lie. And for all the wishing and trying, I couldn't make it have fallen this way. Okay, there it is. That's the direction it fell. In other words, there are all kinds of things that happen in nature that are circumstances that we have nothing to do with. We have no control whatsoever. Now, that fact could really paralyze you because you're afraid of all these forces around you and what's going to fall apart next and, you know, what other storm is going to come through and topple over some tree on top of my house or something. You can become paralyzed with fear because there are so many of these circumstances that you're just passively sitting there looking at and can do nothing to direct, to control, nothing. You're helpless before that. Well, look at verse 4. This verse is discouraging you from that kind of thinking, and it's teaching you that the ideal moment to act may never come. Look at verse 4. It says, he who observes the wind, right, thinking about the weather and everything, he who observes the wind will not sow, and he who regards the clouds will not reap. What is the point of that? Well, here you are. You're kind of a victim of nature, in a sense. And you could, specifically here now as a farmer, get to studying the weather. And, of course, there's a lot more that you and I can do about this today with all of our technology. And get to studying the weather and the patterns of the weather and trying to find just the perfect moment when to act. And most of the time, I am sitting there a little bit nervous and just very analytical and trying to figure all of this out and trying to work out all the details. Looking for just that perfect moment when I know the timing is absolutely right and the weather is good and clear for me to go out and sow the seed. Or when it comes to harvest, waiting till I know it's not going to rain so that it's a great day for me to go out there and reap, and I'm going to get as much harvest as possible in that circumstance. Well, yes, the farmer needs to be aware of weather patterns. He needs to act accordingly as best as he can. But that expression, as best as he can, is the point here. If he is waiting for the perfect moment, he may well end up doing nothing. And I believe that that, again, is especially relevant to certain personality types who are perfectionistic, who are very analytical, who are always looking for just the exact circumstance and the exact response and the exact strategy. Good to be wise, but at a certain point, you just have to venture out. You cannot predict many of these things. The ideal moment may never come. There are a lot of factors that you have no control over, and you don't want to be crippled by this desire for just the right circumstance. And I think that that can also be applied to all of us as we think about different stages in life. Because at different stages, you are making different big decisions. And it is very tempting to think, well, when I get to X situation, to X stage in life, then I will be ready to whatever. Okay? So, for example, a young person says, when I'm mature, when I have some experience, then I will try to serve the Lord in whatever way. Somebody says, when I get married, then I'll get really serious about whatever it is. I'm not even, just fill in the blank, whatever it is. When I have enough money in the bank, when I have a certain amount of real security, then I'll start giving to the needy or giving money to missions. When? And those whens may or may not come. And the way our minds work, when you get to whatever stage, you'll probably have some other reason that you're able to come up with to delay it a little bit more until you feel totally safe that I can do this now. Don't wait till you're quote-unquote ready. You're never really going to be ready. Now, again, this is all in the context of wisdom. We're not trying to be foolish here and unprepared and just kind of shooting from the hip, but this is hitting the other side that there is a faith element that kicks in here, and we're never going to be totally ready. It's like the seminary student who says, I'll go into the ministry when I figure out all my theology. You're going to be figuring out your theology the rest of your life. At a certain point, you're going to say, I've been in seminary for 8 years. I think it's enough. And let's go and do something for the Lord. Now, that connection to the theme of this passage is implicit. In other words, this section does not have a command, but it's really getting at the same idea. You can't guarantee a perfect time to act, and if you do, your success, if you wait on that, your success is definitely going to be hampered. He's basically saying, look, accept your limitations, that a lot of factors are outside of your control, and let your uncertainties and your vulnerabilities actually lead you toward activity, not away from activity. Or I could put it this way, recognize that all of us, the oldest of us, the wisest of us, the most experienced of us, all of us are working in life with approximations and with uncertainties and with degrees of probability. And I'm not speaking here of doctrines revealed in Scripture. I'm talking about our lives and the circumstances of life and how exactly this is all going to pan out and what could happen or what couldn't happen. We're all working on approximations and degree of probability. We are all in the position of having to do the best we can under the circumstances. And yet there's one other element in all of that that I've been hinting at, and that the last couple of verses get at, and that's verses 5 and 6, where we're being instructed, venture out because of God's sovereignty. Venture out because of God's sovereignty. Look at verse 5. What a statement about the sovereignty of God. As you do not know the way the Spirit comes to the bones in the womb of a woman with child, so you do not know the work of God who makes everything. Think about that area of life. He's talking about a baby in a mother's womb. And of course, in our day, again, with technology, we have such better understanding of that whole realm. And yet the more that is discovered by scientists about the process of conception and the development of the embryo and the whole birth process, really, the more blown away we are by it, the more pictures we see, the more mysterious it is, the more we enter into this realm, the more amazing display of the minute sovereign plan of God and his creative power we see. And there is a lot in life like that, that we don't understand. And yet the assurance is, even though you don't understand it and you can't control it, God is definitely, in all of the most minute details, he is governing that area. The thought struck me here that this specific verse, the way it's worded now, particularly in our version, beyond the whole area of the physical birth process, it really is helpful for a famous theological debate that takes place in the area of anthropology. There's something called creationism versus traditionism. And that's not talking about the creation of the world. It's talking about how it is that your soul, your immaterial part, gets attached to your body. Is it that the body comes into existence through the physical union of the man and wife, and then God individually creates the soul and unites it with that body right away? Or is it that in some more mysterious way, the physical act actually brings into being, in the mystery of God's providence, the soul at the same time as the body? And theologians go back and forth about this. And it's one of these things that if you're getting ordained, they might ask you about, and gets very heady. I wish I had this verse in mind at that stage in my life, because what this verse would say, you don't know. That is not a question that the Bible answers for you. So forget about it. Save a few points on your systematic theology test. Make your life a little easier. This passage tells you there is a lot about this. We don't know how it works. Now, you may be looking at a version like the New American Standard that translates the first line a little bit differently. It doesn't really ultimately change the point, but the Hebrew word translated spirit could also be translated wind, so that the first line would read, just as you do not know the path of the wind or how the bones develop and all that goes into conception. And if that is the way to understand it, there actually be two images here of things that are mysterious to us. In fact, over there in John 3, remember Jesus told Nicodemus that you don't know the way of the wind and where it comes from or how it works or where it goes, but you know it's there and it's a mystery to you, but that's like the work of the Spirit. You would actually have two images here in that case, the wind and the physical development of the baby. One of these processes is inside the body, another is outside the body. Both of them are invisible to the naked eye, and neither of them can be probed to our intellectual satisfaction. Either way, whichever way you translate that verse, it brings us to a major note that is sounded in Ecclesiastes, and that is the total sovereignty of God over the entirety of human affairs, big things, small things, visible things, invisible things. All of these things that are unknown to us are not only known to God, but he is actually ruling over them. And notice how it defines God, how it describes God. It says, so you do not know the work of God who makes everything. He makes the wind. He makes the baby. He's not just ruling over it, but he actually created it in the first place, which gives him the total rights to rule over it. Now, with all that emphasis on the sovereignty of God, a verse like this could land you into another theological controversy. And with what is being said here, as some people do, you could end up arguing for a kind of hyper-Calvinism, where God controls everything, He rules over all, He rules over people and their hearts and their responses even to the gospel, and therefore human choice is irrelevant, and human activity is meaningless, everything is predetermined, and so there's nothing meaningful about human choice. And once again, I'm going to say that how we naturally think is the opposite of how the Word of God goes. Because look at the next verse, which is the response to the sovereignty of God. In the morning sow your seed, and at evening withhold not your hand, for you do not know which will prosper, this or that, or whether both alike will be good. He doesn't say, God is sovereign, so just sit there and wait for Him to do whatever He's going to do. He says, God is sovereign, so get out there and do something. That is the Bible's logic when it comes to human activity. God is the one who gives success. The problem is, for us, we don't know which of our ventures is going to prosper. That is actually, our lack of knowledge about what God is doing is actually an argument for working hard and for trusting Him for the results. That is the point of this passage. And it is a lot like James 4:15. If the Lord wills, we will also do this or that. You remember that context, and James is warning us against presumption. Just kind of going out there and acting like we're in charge and doing whatever we want without any reference to God. But when it comes back with that statement, it is not discouraging activity. It is not discouraging risk-taking. It is saying, pursue whatever is on your mind to do and do the hardest job you can and look at it carefully and be wise and look at all kinds of different angles and get involved in whatever affairs that are legitimate for you. But it's all with this mindset. It's all with this posture. If the Lord wills, I don't know what's going to happen. I know God is sovereign. I don't know which of my efforts He's going to prosper. That gives me a lot of rest and confidence and peace. This is the faith element of venturing out. Both Ecclesiastes and James are calling us to a God-reliant aggressiveness, to venture out, but to do so in faith in a sovereign God. So, we venture out because of the consequences, we venture out because of our limitations, and we venture out because of God's sovereignty and with rest and confidence in Him. Now, the applications of this theme are as wide as the individuals gathered in this room. They are as diverse as the talents that everybody has. They are as unlimited, really, as the opportunities that any of us will face throughout the course of our lives. Let me just suggest some things. This is something that you really have to ponder. Now, what does this mean for me? What am I supposed to be venturing out? I can't tell you what that is. You know your life. You know your talents. You know your circumstances. You know your challenges. You know how God is leading you. The big idea here is don't falter and become passive because of uncertainties. The big idea is venture out in faith. Let me throw out some possibilities. I think this could be a good point to make, even with somebody who does not yet know Christ. He says, yes, I believe that Jesus is God, that He came in the flesh, that He died for our sins, but I still have questions. I don't know what this is going to mean for my life. How is this going to affect me? What's the future going to hold? How are people going to treat me if I do this? And the Bible just says, believe on the Lord Jesus Christ and you will be saved. And just trust God for the next step as you venture out in faith, for that very first step of accepting Christ as your Savior. You're not going to have this all worked out in your mind. You're not going to know the future. You trust the God who is sovereign. What about somebody who's considering a relationship? This morning we talked about friendship in our men's class. And the difficulty it is to find time for that and to really nurture those kinds of relationships. And men, speaking to you directly, you know, maybe that lesson prompted some thoughts and there's some other man in the congregation that you are that you're acquainted with, and maybe you would like to get to know better, but you don't know if you have the time, you don't know if how he's going to respond, and you don't know how this is going to work out, or whether he'll open up, or whether you'll feel comfortable opening up, whatever. And this passage urges you, cast your bread upon the waters. Friendship is a good thing to pursue. Make an effort at it. Trust the Lord for whatever happens. Don't let the uncertainty cripple you. Or somebody who needs more education. Or somebody who is pursuing a job. Or somebody who is burdened to witness. And you are crippled by fear because you don't know what the response will be. Or somebody who is considering some ministry here in the church. You know, I thought about this. I am doing Ecclesiastes 11 every time I get up here and preach. I have no idea. All of these gazillion words coming out of my mouth. I have no idea what's going to happen. I mean, preaching is a total act of faith in terms of response. I don't know if you're going to get it. I don't know if you're going to embrace it. I don't know how you're going to use it. I don't know if you're going to remember it. And yet I get up here every week and I do it over and over again. It's a step of faith. I have no guarantees that this is going to do anybody any good. God is sovereign. He'll do whatever he wants. I don't know what he's going to do. And very often in many hearts, the word falls to the ground, right? Jesus, even in the parable of the soils, he says the word goes out. And in three of the four cases, nothing happens. It's an act of faith to give out the word. And speaking of parables, I'll end on this thought with this illustration. What we're being warned against here is the attitude of that guy in the parable of the talents who had a wrong view, really, of his master, or at least we don't want to apply what he said about his master to Christ. But for whatever reason, he took this little talent and he just hid it. I was afraid. Didn't know what was going to happen. And so he just hides it in the ground, does nothing with it. May the Lord preserve us from that kind of fearful, unwise approach to the opportunities of life. May we venture out in faith, making investments for him and trusting him for the results.